This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Natfarm is the state-owned drug manufacturer, and it is facing challenges in supplying the country's hospitals with much-needed drug.
That's Adigando in Bulawayo reporting details coming up. Also, in central Mali, two UN peacekeepers died when their vehicle hit a landmine. The Ebola outbreak in the eastern DRC has spread to the new challenging areas. And Sudan's main opposition leader, Sadiq al-Mahdi, today called on President Omar al-Bashir to step down. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the Democratic Republic of Congo has held its official transfer of power today after the chaos that preceded and followed the presidential election. While Felix Tshisekedi has taken over as president from Joseph Kabila, the future still looks hazy in a country racked by violence since its founding. An opposition leader, Martin Fayulu, who claims he had been cheated out of victory, says he can't work with the new administration. My colleague Paul Alexander has talked with reporter Anastasia Tudishi in Kinshasa about the situation and how it could play out.
A director of cabinet has been appointed. His name is Vital Kamerhe, and he has been the campaign director of President Tshisekedi.
What implications does that carry?
Well, he's the director of cabinet, so he will, along with the president, he will choose the ministers.
Right. Are you surprised that it's not someone more directly related to Kabila?
No, I'm not surprised at all. And I think it's a very interesting and a very good pick because, first of all, Mr. Kamerhe knows the Kabila family and he has been working with them for years. So he's not new to them. He's not a stranger to them. And I think that he would be it's a very strategic and very intelligent choice. Me. And he also gained the confidence of President Tshisekedi. So I think he will be, he's the perfect media between the two teams.
So how does the future of politics look at this point?
It looks very blurred because nothing has transpired, not a word. So I would lie if I would tell you that it will go one way or the other. The only thing one can expect is about minerals, about, you know, the potentiality of Congo. And I think that the new team will work very hard on making sure that the Congolese people will get their share of the potentiality.
So given the country's political unrest in the past, does it seem likely that things will settle down now that there's a new president? Or do you think that there's still the possibility of more violence?
Well, as we are speaking, three civilians have been killed in North Kivu. So I think that the new team will work very hard on this topic because the president has mentioned that as soon as he was elected and yesterday again. So I think that the new team will work on that very, very adamantly. But that's all I can say. I am at Palais de la Nation, which is the presidential house, and I have assisted to, you know, the power handover between the two teams. It has been just like yesterday, very cordial, very, you know, smiling face, and very peaceful also. There is a feeling that they really want to work together and that President Tshisekedi really wants, and he is, he mentioned it, he really wants to start working and make sure that the Congolese people is front and center of his actions.
Where does this leave Martin Fayulu?
So yesterday, during his speech, President Tshisekedi mentioned him and said, and even called him soldier of the people, and he saluted his fight. But I am not sure this will change anything in Mr. Fayulu's position. Last week, he told me while I was interviewing him that he had no intention to work with Mr. Tshisekedi because he considered himself the president-elect and that these elections were rigged and that there was no way he could work with such a team.
That was reporter Anastasie Toudiche talking from Kinshasa with VOA's Paul Alexander. Today in central Mali, two UN peacekeepers died and several were wounded when their vehicle hit a landmine. According to AFP, the men who died were Sri Lankan members of the 14,000-strong UN military and police mission force. The UN force deployed in Mali since 2013 is intended to help countries to counter jihadist activity in the region. The latest casualties come after jihadist gunmen killed 10 Chadian peacekeepers and injured at least 25 others in an attack on a UN camp in northern Mali on Sunday. Mali, one of the poorest countries in the world, has struggled to return to stability since extremists linked to Al-Qaeda took control of the northern part of the country in 2012, promoting France to intervene militarily. The jihadists were routed from key desert towns such as Timbuktu and Gao, but large stretches of the landlocked Sahel state remain out of government control. The recent stay-away protest and demonstrations over the large fuel price increase have affected all of Zimbabwe. The healthcare system, already tittering on the brink of collapse, has particularly been hard hit. Adi Gondo in Bulawayo gives us more on the story.
Because of the economic downturn in the country, Zimbabwe's health delivery system has in recent months been the source of much agony for Zimbabweans. Drugs have been scarce, and the country's medical doctors went on strike in December over pay and working conditions, amongst other things, bedeviling the sector. The strike ended with government commitment to address the medical doctors' concern over conditions within the country's hospitals, such as the shortage of drugs and other basic materials, such as surgical gloves. Last week's stay-away, which had been called for by the workers' representative body, the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions, only exacerbated the situation at the hospitals, with patients bearing the brunt of the protest action. Johannes Ndou, a nurse at one of the hospitals, speaks on his experiences during and after the stay-away.
Like, there are no drugs at government hospitals. When people go to government hospitals, they'll be given prescriptions to go and source drugs, to buy drugs from pharmacies, but when they get to the pharmacies, pharmacies demand US dollars, but no one is getting those US dollars. I'm in contact with such scenarios because you give someone a prescription and you see those people be crying because they cannot afford. And at the end of the day, people do not blame the government. They blame the medical practitioners whom they're in contact with. But we as the medical practitioner, there's nothing we can do.
Another doctor said that the scarce medical resources in the hospitals has forced them to adopt drastic measures. Luke Moyo, a doctor at United Bulawayo Hospital, shares his thoughts on the state of health within the hospital.
So during the stay-away period in anesthesia, we suspended the elective list in anesthesia. Then we only concentrated on emergencies. Then as for now, the drugs are still scarce. The drugs have not yet been supplied from NATFARM. As the sundries as well are not yet available, they are in short supply. There is no gloves, and then the antibiotics are also in short supply. It means we now limit the number of people during the operation. Okay. If an operation needs about 8 people, we can now use about 4 people.
NATFARM is the state-owned drug manufacturer, and it is facing challenges in supplying the country's hospitals with much-needed drugs. The situation within the hospitals is so dire because the hospital dispensaries are still empty despite government assurances to supply drugs to pharmacies. Medical practitioners say that the only way to help the sick in hospitals is to give them a prescription.
And if they come without the medication, there's nothing we can do, just monitor. It's a challenge. Because even to discharge our services is difficult. It's like you are sitting there just monitoring someone without giving that person something that will help them to get better. We are just monitoring them. without giving them the medication. The rate of deaths is increasing. It's increasing because people are not getting any treatment. So at the end of the day, you just nurse someone and that patient dies on the bed because of they can't afford medication.
When the stairway started, patients were left unattended.
We just left them there unattended. Some were discharged because senior doctors like consultants, they went and discharged those who were better. And those who couldn't be discharged, they were left there.
Meanwhile, press reports say that the Zimbabwean government imported US $5 million worth of tear gas canisters, truncheons and batons prior to the stairway. Observers say that many of the country's problems owe much to misplaced government priorities more than any other reason. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo.
The Ebola outbreak in the eastern DRC has marked the highest one-day number of new infections since it was reported in early August, and the deadly disease has spread to two new challenging areas. The developments reflect the challenges of containing the outbreak in an active conflict zone. 14 new cases were reported Wednesday. A spike had been expected after election protests broke out in the area when the central government said it was postponing voting there because of the risk of spreading the disease. The violence forced health workers to stay indoors for several days, interrupting their efforts to treat patients and track their contacts. Officials reported today that Ebola has spread to the Katawa area, where aid agencies have run into community mistrust, and Kayana, which has high security risks. So far, 713 suspected and confirmed cases of Ebola have been reported, with 439 deaths. Seventeen past the hour, you were listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. 8 years ago, as protests erupted across the Middle East and North Africa, thousands of Egyptians took to the streets. They called for democratic change in a country that had been ruled for more than 30 years by Hosni Mubarak. Since then, Egypt's revolutionary spirit has been stifled. A 2013 military coup established Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's government. Many regional political analysts and human rights activists say a climate of fear is felt across the country. Said Sadiq is a professor of political sociology in Egypt. He spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi and offered some reasons for the failure of the Arab Spring in Egypt.
The first reason is that the famous slogan of the revolution, the people want to bring down the regime. Everybody agreed about that, that they want to get rid of the corrupt Mubarak regime. But they disagreed about what is the replacement. And that turned out to be the Achilles heel of this revolutionary coalition that led to toppling Mubarak. Secondly, you had foreign powers intervening. Our area is notorious for hosting long-serving dictators who also poured money into different forces to obstruct the process. Thirdly, you had the state institutions remained in the hands of the Ancien regime of Mubarak, and they controlled all the networks, police, the judiciary, media, the army. So the revolutionary had nothing in their hands. Another factor was rush to early general and presidential election, when all political forces, the new political forces that emerged from the revolution, were not ready. And immediately after the revolution, the old deep state asked for quick elections, and that meant the old forces who are seasoned in election, like the Muslim Brotherhood and the old regime cronies, were able to take over the parliament and the presidential seat. Also, the images of failure and tragedies befalling other Arab Spring countries, Syria, Libya, Yemen, images of refugees suffering, gave the revolution a bad name, and also democratization. We just felt if democratization means that we will become refugees like the Syrians or be in chaos like in Yemen and Libya, We don't want it. There was no successful model from the Arab Spring emerging, even Tunisia. It has an ailing economy and endless paralyzing labor strikes. The image of revolutionaries in Egyptian media that was controlled by the counter-revolution distorted them. And so all these factors affected the transition and the support for revolution and support for democratization. People felt democratization may lead to Syria, another Iraq or Yemen or Libya. We don't want this.
With the military takeover after the second wave of uprising against the failure of Muslim Brotherhood after 1 year in power, did the Arab Spring in Egypt change the everlasting choice between the Islamists and the military?
Not at all. They still play this game. And the result is that you have this Al-Azhar and the army are controlling society. And this is the formula that has always existed. Now you are only excluding the Muslim Brotherhood, but not other Islamic groups like the Salafis who are also supporting the regime. And people in Egypt just feel that the existing system is fine with them as long as we don't end up like our neighbors. And Sisi is playing the same old trick, mega project and stability. And that gives people hope that they are on the right track and that despite all political and media repression and economic hardship, at least we have a home. And so there is tolerance of what is happening and they accept this kind of game. Every now and then there is criticism, but it doesn't reach the level of a third revolution because they feel that a revolution is not the way to make change, and they are accepting gradual transitional reform, not sudden eruption that can lead to a worse situation than we are living today.
But with the current constraints over freedom of expression and with poor performance of political parties, is there any hope for a democratic transition in Egypt in the near future?
Democratization is a long, historical, gradual, slow process. It takes time. And at least today, as a result of the revolution that took place in Egypt, it is no longer easy for the government to play with the constitution. And I think the rulers of Egypt today realize that they no longer can rule in the same way as in the past. And that is, by the way, an achievement.
That was Said Sadiq, professor of political sociology in Egypt. He was speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. Sudan's main opposition leader, Sadiq al-Mahdi, today called on President Omar al-Bashir to step down. The former prime minister told worshippers at a Khartoum mosque that the government must go immediately, echoing the demands of thousands of Sudanese who have held demonstrations nearly daily for 5 weeks. Also today, hundreds of protesters marched through the city of Omdurman until police fired tear gas at them and they fled. Police said that yesterday at least 2 people died during anti-government protests across the country. Police did not specify how they died. The government says at least 30 people have died since the protest over the crumbling economy began. Human rights groups say more than 40 people have died. Sadiq al-Mahdi was prime minister in 1989. His government was the last democratically elected one in Sudan. After that, Omar al-Bashir took power and he has ruled ever since. The Carter Center in Atlanta says known cases of guinea worm disease in humans have diminished to just 28 worldwide, all in Chad, South Sudan, and Angola. By contrast, in 1986, when the NGO began to lead the global eradication program, there were an estimated 3.5 million cases reported in Africa and Asia. Still, in 2018, over 1,000 cases of guinea worms were detected in dogs, cats, and other animals. Adam Weiss directs the Carter Center's global eradication program. He told VOA's Adam Phillips that the life cycle of the guinea worm begins when people drink stagnant water containing the tiny crustaceans that carry its larvae.
Those eggs or larvae are consumed by a water flea, which is common in all stagnant water sources around the world. That's where the larva can develop and become infective. And if anybody consumes that water, they will then ingest the larvae that are at an infective stage. And 1 year later, they will become infected with guinea worm. So from the point of infection to the point of a worm emerging from your body is 1 year later. And it generally forms a small blister with a very strong burning sensation. And people want to soothe the area and may actually submerge their limb into the water to help cool down the infection.
Oh, I see. And then the blister bursts and the mature worm releases more eggs and ova into the water, perpetuating the cycle.
Correct.
So what can be done to get that guinea worm out before they seek relief in the water?
You can help to roll the worm as it's emerging. And this is a process that can take many weeks. The worm generally cannot be pulled out in one fell swoop, but over many days, weeks, you can gradually massage the area and slowly pull the worm out.
And there's no cure for guinea worm or some kind of a vaccine to prevent it?
There's no cure, there's no vaccine, but there are a number of interventions to try and interrupt the life cycle. There's a chemical that can be applied to water sources to help minimize the population of copepods, which is the intermediary host. There's also the distribution of cloth filters and pipe filters, which is a very low cost and very effective measure for filtering the water to remove the larvae and copepods from any water that you might drink.
And I know that very rigorous surveillance is key in the global eradication effort.
The surveillance system for guinea worm is the backbone of the eradication effort. There are village volunteers selected by their own community to identify guinea worm, and they're trained to treat people who have the disease. They're trained to provide behavior change messaging about how to prevent the disease and how to report it and document it as well.
And of course, there are systemic issues. I'm thinking of the UN Sustainable Development Goal number 7, clean water and sanitation.
Absolutely. If every person in the world had access to safe potable water all day, every day, we wouldn't be talking about guinea worm disease.
It must be really heartbreaking to see some of these cases.
Yeah. Every night I think about people that I help support to pull worms out of who were in dire pain. And it's the type of pain that can make any grown man cry.
I understand that one of the challenges for people trying to eradicate this is that the cases that remain are the hardest to stamp out.
Absolutely. The end game of all eradication programs is known to be the most difficult. Smallpox eradication went through the same process. Polio eradication efforts are facing the same challenges. We're talking about the most marginalized people. They're often beyond the end of the road where there is a dearth of infrastructure. And so it is a challenge, but it can be done, and it is being done as we speak. In Ethiopia, in 2017, there were 15 human cases, and in 2018, there were 0 human cases. In Mali, they have gone more than 3 years without a human case. And those are two major milestones that the global campaign is extremely proud of, and both the national programs in Ethiopia and Mali are equally proud of.
That was Adam Weiss, the director of the Carter Center's Global Eradication Program in Atlanta. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips from Chad. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, our engineer, Thomas Blondet, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.